Welcome to the Plodcast. This is Douglas Wilson. This is episode 321 of the Plodcast. You are most welcome aboard. Thank you for coming. The topic today I want to talk about is therapeutic damage. Therapeutic damage. The reason I'm talking about this is because of a book I'm reading, but this is not a book review, but I do need to mention the book. It's by Abigail Schreier, and she's the woman who wrote the book on called Irreversible Damage, on the impact that the tranny stuff is having on kids. Irreversible Damage is hers, but she's got a new book out called Bad Therapy. And it's a marvelous book, really insightful book. So there's my book plug at the beginning. But but going through the book made me think of some things that I wanted to share with you all. We have certain assumptions that we pick up from the world, and the world picks them up from the psychiatric professions. Here's one of them, and it's a commonplace, and that is many problems that adults have, emotional problems, psychological problems, difficulties in coping with this, that, and the other thing, are the result of childhood trauma. And the thing that you have to do is get the person to open up about that trauma, to talk about it, to ventilate. Now, one of the things that we should do is, if we are thoughtful about these sorts of things, we should ask questions like, how do we know that? How do we know that? Let's say that someone had a particular traumatic episode when they're a child. I think all of us can easily imagine how someone could have coped with the trauma in a really unhelpful way, you know, in a way that caused all sorts of emotional dislocations downstream. We all can imagine that. But can we imagine a person who had a real shock to the system saying, you know what, I don't want to talk about it. I want to think about something else, and admire that as the best thing he could have done? Because all of us have been affected the way we've been affected by the world of psychology, we don't want to acknowledge that that is even a possibility, because the world of psychology operates on the assumption that repression of every sort is bad. Repression of, whether it's repression of emotional responses or repression of perceptions or repression of sexual urges, or, you know, the releasing of repression, the opening up, the unbottling, the uncorking of what was previously suppressed, our culture wants to just flat out applaud, right? But is there no danger of hovering over a problem and hovering over the problem until the cure is worse than the problem itself? Is there no scab that you can't make 10 times worse by picking at it for 20 years? Suppose someone was molested, and let's say the person who molested them sexually went to jail, and good riddance, and that's, we're fine with that. But can you imagine, and I hope you can you imagine that episode being revisited time after time after time and kept alive, so the scar tissue never forms, so that the patient, the client, is never enabled to move on? All right. So think of it. Here's another way of thinking about it. If you went to a therapist and they said something like, I want you to know about our policy at the front end. We agree to see you for 6 sessions, 1 month apart. And after that, our arrangement is over. If we can't help you in 6 sessions over 6 months, then we don't think we're going to be able to help you. And if we don't think we're going to be able to help you, we refuse to treat you as a cash cow. We refuse to treat you as someone who is going to keep coming back and continue to pay us money. That would be unethical. Now, would your respect for that office go up or down if they told you that? Would it go up or down? I think it would go up. They're interested in helping, and if they can't help, they'll tell me that they can't help. And if they helped, then we will all know, right? Here's another problem with the world of therapy, and that is when you go to an attorney and he takes you on as a client, you're paying him money to represent you. He has an ethical obligation to go into court and represent your best interest. He's there to represent your account, your perspective, your take on things. If you go to a therapist and you're paying him money, a similar thing happens, right? And the similar thing is that he is receiving money from you and you become his client. And as his client, he feels some sort of pressure, some sort of obligation to believe your account. So that creates a pressure to distort the truth. Let's say your account involved alleging some grievous offense on the part of someone else. If that someone else was traumatized by you and they came to the same therapist first, that same therapist would now be receiving money to take that person's perspective. Always will be God. Continuing with the podcast, episode 321. Welcome to Hamartiology, the class in which we are studying all the things we've been doing since we were toddlers, but which we never had a name for. We are, of course, studying the different New Testament words for different kinds of sins. Our word this time around is katokaiomai, which means to boast. Like a number of other words, the sinfulness depends on the context or the direct object or something outside of us, the word itself. For example, this word is used in James 2:13 in a righteous sense, where mercy rejoiceth against judgment. Okay? Mercy boasts against judgment. It's the same word, and the context makes it righteous. So when mercy rejoices against judgment, when mercy boasts against judgment, that is entirely a good thing. But there are obviously ungodly examples. And here's the first one, and the verb occurs twice in this verse. This is Romans 11:18. Boast not against the branches, but if thou boast, thou bearest not the root, but the root thee. All right, so the word is boast, katokaiomai. Boast not against the branches, but if thou boast. So there are the two instances. The context is Gentile Christians boasting over against the Jewish branches of the olive tree, who had been cut out because of their unbelief. Paul's warning is that this boasting was the very beginning of the attitude that the Jews had given way to, the attitude that resulted in their condemnation. So be careful, Paul is saying, because the same thing could happen to you. Don't boast against the Jewish branches who were removed because of the consequences of their boasting. Right, don't you boast against them when it was their boasting that caused them to be removed in the first place. The other passage that condemns this attitude is found in James 3:14. But if ye have bitter envying and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth. James 3:14. And the rendering there is the glory not, boast not, basically. There's a kind of competition that is not healthy at all. Of course, there's nothing wrong with running a race in order to win the race. But there is a kind of ego race that is always wrong. In such a case, the desire is not so much as to win the race as it is to make other people lose it. When that happens, there's a real kink in the hose. If you want to win the race because that's why you entered it, that's what athletes who run races do. They try to win it. But that's one thing. But if your sole desire is to see other people weep, if your sole desire is to see other people lose, then there you really have a heart problem. So if you have that kind of bitter envy and striving, glory not, James says, boast not. When you do that, you're giving way to lies, and you wind up living in a way that lies against the truth. God don't never change, he's God. Continuing on with the podcast, episode 321. My book review this time is a short little book. Well, it's a medium book. It's called Ruler of Kings, and it's by Joe Boot. Ruler of Kings by Joe Boot. Now, I said an episode or two ago, I forget which one it was, I said an episode or two ago that I was reviewing a lot of the material that I learned from the early Rushdoony, the early Reconstructionists, when they were putting out a number of very cogent, very insightful, very thoughtful pieces on the nature of God and creation, God to creation, and God's law, God's word to our daily lives. So that is a helpful and a salutary exercise. But Joe Boot is, I would describe, as very much an heir of that tradition. So he is, and I have no idea if he would call himself a Reconstructionist, quite possibly not, but he's working on the same kind of project. He is a Christian apologist, theologian, a very careful thinker. I was just privileged to be speaking at a conference with him down in Texas. I had to drive across a chunk of Texas to get there, and I came to the conclusion that the this Texas state flower must be a multi-layered high-level overpass. So went through one overpass. I think it had five. Never mind. That's Texas. That's not this. That's not this book. But I was listening to Joe's book on the way to the conference where he was talking, and I'm just really impressed with his work. This book, Ruler of Kings, is a brief for basically it's a synopsis of explicitly Christian political theory. Explicitly Christian political theory. There's certain basic things that all Christians really ought to affirm. Because we believe that only God is unlimited, that means that we must affirm the necessity of limited government. Because unlimited government among fallen, sinful, finite human men is going to want to rival God, and it is a very grievous sin for men to want to rival God. Only God is sovereign. Only God is unlimited. Only God is God. But if you affirm secularism and you say there is no God above the state, in effect, you are saying that the state becomes God. If there is no God, if there is no transcendent absolute authority over the state, then the state becomes that absolute authority. And nobody should want that. So one of the things that Christians really ought to be doing in these our troubled times is brushing up on explicitly biblical, explicitly Christian political theory. And this book is a good place to start. Ruler of Kings by Joe Boot.